Hey guys, can we do the intro real fast?
Sure.
Okay. We'll see how this goes.
Hello, the best 3.5 Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long.
That's about right. Hello and welcome to the Cultcast, the best 30-plus minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. My name is Arifon Elijah. I'm back with King Caney, owner, creator of Cultamac.com. Hey, Leander.
Hello.
We're also joined by deputy editor John Brownlee, not John Browett, John Brownlee. Welcome back to the show, John. We need to have you on more often.
Well, thank you very much. I've been waiting for that offer all along.
Because I so thoroughly enjoy having you on that we should make that happen. And before we continue, I do want to mention that we are sponsored this week by the fine folks at DigiDNA.net, and they are the makers of Discade 5, the iPod, iPhone, iPad transfer tool for Mac and PC. We're going to be telling you how you can get 30% off a license to that great software, and also how you can win a license on our Facebook page. But before we do that, what better way to start the show than with some shout outs to our listeners? Now, to our listener. Shout out to our listener. First one, Josh Vasquez from Springfield, Massachusetts. He has been trying to get me to do a shout out for three or four weeks now. And every time he tweets me about it, I'm like, oh, I'm going to for sure do it, right? And he keeps tweeting me, like, right up to the show. And I'm like, it's definitely happening this show. And then every single show, I forget, and he's always grossly disappointed in me. So Josh from Springfield, Massachusetts, there is your shout-out. Thanks for listening. And hey, I before the show, I actually tweeted out if you guys wanted to have your name and city and country tweeted, or a shout-out, I should say, to tweet me. So let's just try to go through some of them just so we can give you guys some attention, because we really appreciate you listening to the show. So we've got Matt. I'm going to butcher these. Matt Chinander from Iowa City, Iowa. Lucas from Michigan. Jack Cardiff. Didn't say where he was from. We've got Rodrigo from Brazil. Spencer from Alabama. We've got... Okay, now this is a Swedish name. Malmo from Sweden. We've got Nick Salazar from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Amjid from Halifax, UK. Does that ring a bell? No?
Not really, no.
Silken from England?
Oh, that I recognize that.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Silken. Yeah, that ring a bell with me as well. Let's see here. Jack Chandler from Cardiff. Matt M. from the U.S. Sasha from Slovenia. Pat Redmond he's from Ireland. Oh, beautiful. Actually, I grew up in Redmond, Washington. That's kind of a coincidence. We've got Travis from Corvallis, Oregon. Tej from Layton, Utah. We've got Jimmy from D.C. Brendan from Lake Oswego, Oregon. Aid Hanta from Mumbai, India. Noah Shepherds from the U.S. Okay, Malmo, he's doing a double dip here. Malmo.
We go for the hat trick.
We've got Yvonne Redmond from Ireland. Wow. Two people with last names of Redmond from Ireland, then they must be related in some way. And boy, you guys, this list just keeps going and keeps going. I can't get to all these. We probably got about 50 of them, but we're going to do this again for sure. So thanks to everyone who tweeted me with a shout out. We've got so much stuff to talk about on the show today. I thought that we could start with a couple light news items, kind of warm up the show. What do you guys think?
All right.
Oh, yeah.
Leander, I know you're into news, so yeah. You're going to be really into these. Well, let's start with iTunes. A lot of people have been asking me if we know when iTunes 11 is going to come out. It's, of course, been pushed back till sometime in November. Am I correct, John?
Yes, you are.
And do we have any idea when we're expecting to see that?
Well, according to my inside sources, it's coming out sometime in November. It's been pushed back a month. I don't know. I think it's a major overhaul. I guarantee that you know, the forestall firing ended up disrupting things enough that it got delayed. You know, it's no real surprise, but I mean, we can make do for another month with, you know, the same iTunes that we've been living with for, you know, years now.
Yeah, I was actually, I'm surprised that so many people have been asking about this, because are you guys all that excited about a new iTunes?
Yeah.
You are?
Yeah, because it's the current one is such a higgledy-piggledy mess that if the rumors are they're going to simplify it a lot and there's going to be a lot better integration with the store. You know, I'm looking forward to something being improved. I don't know whether they can deliver on it, but
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, it's just got more and more bloated with each release, and now it's bloated that it's definitely the worst app that Apple does.
But I don't think that they can – I mean, they can't drop functionality from it. So I think what they're going to do is they're just going to hide functionality wherever they can. And there's ways that they can do that. But I don't think it's going to be any less bloated. I just think that it's going to be a lot more elegant about which functionality it shows to users. I mean, you know, iTunes needs to, you know, support a huge number of devices. And I mean, people talk about how bloated it is, and I agree it's not elegant, but I mean, I don't think that's, I mean, there's, you can't really drop functionality from it at this point, and stripping out a lot of this functionality to other apps doesn't really work either.
I wouldn't say it's bloated, it's just big boned. In other news, we have a new version of iOS for you to update to. It's 6.0.1. Tell me this isn't confusing. In order to update, you need to download an updater app that will update your updater app so you can update your iPhone.
It's actually not that confusing.
Did that make you go cross-eyed, Leander?
It does, yeah. Your explanation, which is exactly right. That's exactly what it does. But in real life, it was actually quite simple. It just popped up a little thing saying you need to, to update this updater to update your update.
And it's only on the iPhone. I mean, it is funny, but it's only on the iPhone 5 and, like, it's only if you're doing it over the air. Like, if you plug it into iTunes, it'll update, you know.
Oh, really? Oh,
perfectly.
Okay.
It's only for Delta updates.
All I'm saying is somebody needs to create a meme with Exhibit. Do you know which meme I'm talking about, John?
I don't think I do.
Oh, you don't? Never mind. Well, I'm sure there are listeners out there who do. So,
is it a two girls, one cup thing?
No, most definitely not. I haven't updated yet either. So you guys are saying it's pretty easy to do. You just plug it in and everything handles itself in typical Apple style, yeah?
You don't even plug it in. It's it's a Wi-Fi update. So.
But John, weren't you just saying that if you did it via iTunes and you plugged it in, then you wouldn't need to that updater?
Yeah. No. Yeah, if you plug it in through iTunes, it'll work fine. It's only if you're updating over the air on the iPhone 5, and even then, it's like, as Leander says, it just kind of, you know, just happens. It happens. It works. It's not a big deal. You know.
It is funny explaining it, though. I'm still snickering at my own comments.
Keep snickering all the way through. This is going to love it.
Oh, man. Well, let's move on to the big stuff. My gosh, what a major week. We had a shakeup at Apple. We've got two executives leaving. And I feel like the saga just keeps continuing. We just keep hearing updates on why Scott Forstall was let go, why John Browett was let go, and John Brownlee, by the way, every time I say his name, I want to say your name.
Every time I write his name, I write my name.
Because it's literally only two letters different, right?
Well, it's like three, but it's still like, every time I'm writing a John Browett is an idiot who doesn't know what he's doing, like, post, it's always like, I'm always writing my own name, you know, which is probably, you know, I mean, it's probably apt.
They are very, very close. So I'm going to do my best not to talk about you during the show and how Apple fired you. Although if they did, you'd probably be a lot wealthier than you are now. It wouldn't be such a bad thing.
That's true. I can only dream of being fired by Apple today.
Yeah, that would be the high point in my life.
Yeah, that's my goal. My goal is to be fired by Apple someday.
Well, let's talk about what happened. So, big stirrup, of course. Let's talk about Scott Forstall first, since he was kind of the major executive that was let go. One of the things I learned recently, I have to admit, I didn't know a ton about Scott Forstall. I kind of knew what he did at Apple. But did you guys know that he was a next holdover? He came over to Apple with Steve Jobs. I mean, he's been with the company for 15 years, and we know now, obviously, that he was very close to Steve. Do you guys think that it's a good thing that Apple let him go? It's a bad thing? I mean, what are your thoughts on the issue? Let's start with you, Leander.
Well, it seems to be a good thing. I mean, the trouble is that you don't really know, what was going on behind the scenes. I think there's been a lot of rumors that Forstall was hard to work with, and he was abrasive, and
he was like Steve Jobs in his youth, really.
Yeah, right. And of course, and he was making a power play. Now, I'm not really sure which of the rumors I was, inclined to believe. I think that what makes most sense is that. What they said in the actual release, Apple's always been quite plain spoken. And one of the things that all the Steve Jobs keynotes over the years, he would actually sort of explain quite clearly where their thinking came from. And in the press release, it was, it was pitched not as, firing two troublesome executives, but as in increasing integration and collaboration across some key technology areas. And of course, you focus on Forstall getting the boot and Brouwer getting the boot because he was clearly a disaster. But, if you see what they picked up, the executives that remain, it does make a lot of sense. Now you have one guy who's in charge of all software, iOS and Mac software. Mm-hmm. You have someone who's in charge of Johnny Ive is now in charge of, both hardware and software, but from a UI point of view, from a human interface point of view. Bob Mansfield, the former head of hardware who tried to retire, and they were so Tim Cook was so freaked out about him leaving that now he's in charge of this sort of technologies group, which is supposed to be looking at chips and wireless technologies. So I don't know, it seems to make a lot of sense that they're it was a bit fractured before. You had like three guys who were in charge of software and two guys who were in charge of hardware. Now it's been split up, and Eddie Q in charge of online services. So it seems to be a lot more rationalized these days. So it seems like a good thing.
I have learned more about Apple executives and what they all actually do and their histories in the last 2 days than I've known in the last 5 years. It's been crazy because I've been researching it. And one of the things I learned in doing some research on Wikipedia is that Scott Forstall, he had a major, technical contribution to Apple. He helped develop OS X, and he was responsible for the teams that developed Leopard, and he led the UI, the development of the UI. I'm forgetting the name of it. Help me out here, guys.
Which UI? Mac or iOS?
On Mac, on iOS. I'm sorry, on Mac OS X. On Mac, on iOS. Aqua. Just say Aqua, something, damn it. Yes, Aqua, thank you. Which of course, was a major development in OS X, right? Because it made it look so much better.
Right.
I'm a little worried that him leaving is going to affect Apple negatively in that regard, because he was so integral in developing OS X and even, the touch interface of iOS. I mean, he led the teams that helped develop that. John, do you have any concerns about him leaving and Apple losing kind of like a technical luminary?
Well, okay, and I don't know. Like, I don't think Scott Forstall was a technical luminary, and I don't know. Like, I really don't. But I mean, I think that. I still do have concerns about him leaving. A lot, I think that the big question for me is whether, is Johnny Ive is now in charge of design across the board, and there is. As far as I know, Johnny Ive has never designed a piece of software ever. Like, I mean, we know that he builds hardware, but I mean, the considerations that go into designing a computer or something that sits in your living room are completely different to what goes into creating a usable interface that is understandable to people. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's like a really interesting question. Like, can Ive do this? Like, Forstall gets a lot of crap from me included for the skeuomorphic stuff, but skeuomorphism is a proven design principle that works. I mean, you can at least say that. You may think it's tacky and ugly and all of these things, but
and sometimes it can be, I think.
Yeah, and it can be. It can be. I feel like I go both ways. Like, I love skeuomorphism except when I hate it. Like,
right.
But like I don't think the podcast app is that bad. People talk about it. Like, I'm just like, oh no, I think this is kind of charming and cool. I think Find My Friends is like somebody puked in my eye, but like, but podcast, the podcast app is fine. Like, people talk about skeuomorphism as if that's the bad thing, and it's not. But you know, and so when you hear things like where Johnny Ive is just like, Johnny Ive hates skeuomorphism, it's going to be eliminated from Apple products across the board. Like, you don't know what that means, but I do kind of arch my eyebrow. Like, I mean, the Mac desktop in and of itself is skeuomorphic. Like, you're looking down at something that is supposed to be a virtual desktop. Like, I mean, what does this mean? Like, can he do it? And is it, you know, what does, I mean, and does he actually have good ideas about software design? Like, why didn't Steve put him in charge of this to begin with? Like, there's all sorts of questions. Who knows?
I think, you know, the role that Ive is moving into is the role that previously that Steve Jobs himself inhabited, which is a sort of company tastemaker. He was the one who had, you know, put taste judgments on whatever they were releasing, and Jobs's judgments were often, you know, sort of, you know, the way he worked, he always wanted a range of options, and he would choose the one he liked best, and it was very from the gut, it was intuitive, you know, he could tell you why he didn't like something, but he often couldn't provide, you know, the direction. He couldn't say, I want you to do this. Do you know what I mean? And I think Ive has obviously fulfilled that role on the hardware side for more than a dozen years at Apple, so. You know, if you take it for granted, and like they said, like Tim Cook said, when he was promoted into this role, you know, he has been the aesthetic heart of the company for more than a dozen years, and if he can provide that same, that, you know, the same sense of taste to software, you know, I think it bodes well.
Let me fill in the gaps here, just for those that haven't been following the Ive Forstall responsibility exchange here. So Scott Forstall was very much into skeuomorphism, which was designing products, software, that looked like, you know, items that you use in real life, which is why Calendar had like the leather bound top. The podcast app has those two tape reels that spin. And actually, I really like the podcast app. As you were saying, John, those two tape reels, I think they work brilliantly. Johnny Ive reportedly hates that stuff. And, you know, he's been put in charge of a new division at Apple, kind of like the human interface division. And he's going to be responsible not only for the way hardware looks, but the way the software looks as well, which is in kind of an intriguing thing when you think about it, because now he gets to design or help, you know, create how the products look on the outside, but also when you're looking at them, you know, on the inside. And John, your point is actually really, really good. I mean, I think that, you know, Ive is obviously a master at creating well-designed products on the outside, but, you know, software and interacting with software is a much different set of skills. It's not just how good does this look. Although I think you could also argue that he has been doing some of that too. You know, I mean, he helps design with the placement of things on, you know, on all the computers and devices that Apple designs. So it's going to be really intriguing to see what happens. Yes.
You know, there's definitely a need for a new vision because, and especially on the software side, because as far as I'm concerned, you might not like what's going on with Windows Phone or something, but they're doing some really interesting stuff now. Things are definitely moving like kind of into a post skeuomorphic age. Like, I think a lot of people have started looking at the look of iOS as kind of old, and as Windows 8 now is coming out, I think people are going to start looking at the way that the Mac is designed as sort of you know, an older and less daring approach. And I think that Apple has always been about the fusion of hardware and software. You know, like Microsoft is about the delineation between hardware and software, but Apple is all about how hardware and software just are one. Just like in a human, like your brain and your body are one thing. Like in a computer, that's what, you know, software and hardware are supposed to be work as one. So it makes a lot of sense to me that Johnny Ive would become the design heart of that, just as he has been the design heart of the hardware side. My only concern, and I think that there's some great things, like clearly there's a need for a change in vision, but all I'm saying is that Jony Ive is completely unproven when it comes to software design, as far as I know.
Well, I'll tell you, to your point about Microsoft being daring with their software, you know, on Windows 8 phone, and I played with the Surface the other day. I went into a Microsoft store, into the enemy's den, if you will, and put a shawl over my head so no one would recognize me. I sat there playing with the Windows Surface tab, and my opinion only, I thought it was dreadful. I mean, dreadful. I was playing with this thing, and I was handing it to people around me, and I was watching them play with it, and a lot of people were confused on how it worked. The UI isn't nearly as good as the iPad. Now, this is coming from a Mac user, right? And I'm really immersed in the Apple world. I just found it to be really kind of a disjointed experience, and the hardware isn't nearly as good as the iPad either. That's a whole different discussion. But I mean, I see your point about Apple having kind of an older UI, especially now that we've been using it for, what, 5 years? And we could use some drastic changes, but I still think it's very good and definitely better than the Windows mobile experience.
Oh, I don't know if I agree, actually. Really? Like I love what Windows Phone. I mean, I don't know. I don't have any thoughts about Windows 8. I don't necessarily think that the metaphor that they're trying to extend to the desktop works. Mm-hmm. But in regards to Windows Phone 7 and Windows Phone 8, I think it's great. Like, I mean, it's fantastic. Like, and even if you're an Apple fan, I think you should appreciate it, because unlike Android, it's not just one of Apple's competitors ripping them off wholesale. Like, you know, Microsoft sat down and they're like, we want to revolutionize, you know, touch-based interfaces. This is our idea of how a touch-based interface should work. And their vision doesn't really work anything like Apple's vision, and that's okay. Like, I think that's awesome, you know? And I think Apple thinks that's awesome, too. Like, Apple doesn't want other companies not to compete with them. What they want is competitors who are going to be doing their own thing, who are going to push Apple to do better and better products. And I really like Windows Phone 7. If I didn't have an iPhone, I would have a Windows Phone. Like, no question in my mind. Like, huh. I think it's a great thing.
It's funny how it hasn't taken off, though, has it? Because, I mean, did you see those wire statistics that the Windows 8 launch on Monday got only a fraction of the number of people they got for the iPad Mini launch, or previous Apple live keynote events? I mean, a lot of people recognize that Microsoft's made a great interface for their phone, and yet nobody wants it.
Well, see, this is kind of my thing, and building on what you just said, Leander, and to your point, John, about having Microsoft do something different, I applaud them. What they've done is really, really different, and I think it's amazing that they have been able to come up with another solution that's nothing like Apple and not just be another company that hops on board the Apple UI train. But to your point, Leander, I'm like, yeah, I wonder if people like it, because I always hear people applauding them for doing something different. But I rarely hear someone say that they actually really love it for what it is, and on the merit of its design, and not just for being different. John, you're one of the only people that I've heard say that you really actually like it.
Oh, yeah. No, I really do. In fact, maybe I'll make this my rave later, but the music app.
That's not allowed.
The music app I use on my iPhone is inspired by Windows Live Tiles, and it's great. I love it. I do think they're cool. And, you know, to your point, Leander, about why I thought John Gruber at Daring Fireball, everybody reads him, so everybody knows what I'm about to say. But, like,
I don't know who you're talking about, actually.
He runs a popular New York Yankees blog. He mentioned something, I think, which I thought was accurate, which is just that, like, you know, the problem with Windows events is there's no surprises, like, because Microsoft has to make all of these partnerships and they have to sell their software to all sorts of people. So when you go to them, there's no, like, Apple, there's always that chance that you can be surprised.
Yeah, now, no one knew what Apple was going to announce during that latest iPad mini.
Yeah, right. I was just thinking that too.
No, well, I mean, that's just because of leaks. That's not because the companies that Apple deals with have, like, called the press already.
Oh, I see, like, what you're saying. Like, by the time it comes out of Microsoft, they've already revealed everything.
Well, yeah, they've got a business model. I mean, their customers really are the OEMs, not the end user.
Yeah. So
they have to reveal everything ahead of time. They have a very clear roadmap.
Hmm. Yeah, although it looks like they're trying to change that, right?
Oh yeah, they're definitely trying to change that. I mean, because that's not the future, and they know it. You know, you can't be, you know, you can't, you know, like Apple's model's the future. Like, you know, and I think that you know, you're going to continue to see Microsoft lock down, you know, their software to hardware that they design, as they have done with all of their most popular products. Like, you know, I mean, the Surface, like, I mean, our good friend Buster Heine was at the Microsoft store and the Microsoft store has never had more than two customers in it at once. Like, in fact,
true.
I thought the universe might collapse on itself if it did, but he took pictures of, you know, 1,000 people in line or something, like lines stretched across around the block for the Surface. And you look at the Xbox 360, that's Microsoft's best product as far as I'm concerned. Like,
I totally agree. I don't even put the Xbox in the same category as other products. The Xbox rules supreme. I mean, it is the best video game console out there.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it's an integrated thing. Like, the right. software and the hardware are one. Microsoft knows it. Like, and when and that's where they're going. You know, that's why they're, you know, this Nokia partnership that they have. Sorry, it's Nokia officially, but like again, like, you know, the ultimate goal there is to have an official Windows Phone 8 phone, you know, and we're going to see that sooner rather than later.
You know, my Windows store, I mean, I'm in the heart of it, right? I mean, I'm in Seattle, I'm in Redmond. This is where Microsoft has their most power. And, you know, our store was packed, jam-packed with people. And I didn't really see anyone leaving with bags. Everyone was in there checking stuff out, but I didn't see a lot of purchases being made. Just anecdotal, just saying. Because, you know, when you go into Apple, you see people leaving with stuff all the time.
Mm, yeah.
So I wonder if people were there just kind of being like, oh, this is new. Microsoft has a tablet. Ooh, that's great. Let's go to the Apple store now. All right, well, hey, let's move on to John Browett, because he was let go as well. I want to give him some attention, although he wasn't an Apple very long, and he was the guy that they pulled from Dixon's, which was the European electronic chain, put him in charge of the Apple store. And he came in, and basically what he did was slash staff, and it looked like he was really focusing on profits. And they let him go as well. I think this is a good thing, agreed, because, I mean, Apple's kind of main marketing front is their Apple stores. You go in there, and it is critical, in my opinion, that you have an amazing experience when you go into an Apple store.
I don't know if it's critical, because I've never had an amazing experience
really?
At an Apple store. Like, no.
I mean, wow.
Actually, I'm sorry. I have had one or two times, but considering I've been in there like two or three dozen times as customers, like, usually I don't, honestly.
Lander, what were you about to say?
Well, you know, I always had a good experience, but usually when you go in to buy something and it's, you know what you're going to get, and
well, we do.
The experience in the Apple, you know, I haven't had some amazing experience in the Apple store, but they were mostly in New York, like the one on Prince Street in Soho. Uh-huh. And when I was staying in New York a couple of summers ago, you know, I went by one day and there's a huge crowd and there's this music coming out, and it's Wyclef Jean. He's given a concert, you know, upstairs.
John.
And they had, you know, then I looked on the calendar, and that whole week they had talks by you know, who was the guy, the famous, there's Hollywood sound, you know, guys, there's famous photographers, there's cinematographers, and because it's right in the heart of, you know, New York's creative community, these guys all use this gear. And it was a hub, you know, for this creative community, at least at the time, you know, a couple of years ago. And I think it's the same. I don't think it's changed. You know, the Apple Store in my local mall, it's just a store in the mall. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when you go in there, it's all blue shirts. I mean, there's about 40 people that work in that store. And you can't go, you know, 3 feet deep without being asked, you know, three times, do you have your kit? And when I read about what Brad was doing, it was like, okay, you know, like he said he wanted to thin it out a bit because they had too many people working in the stores. And and that definitely resonated. I was like, you know, maybe he's got a point. There is a hell of a lot of people working in there.
Actually, you know what? You may have just swayed me. Yeah, because the one thing I don't like about Apple stores is how you constantly get asked if you need help when you're in there. It's like, I realize there are grandma and grandpas in there that may never have used a computer before and they need a lot of guidance. But for guys like us, it's like, my gosh, we know what we want. Leave me alone.
Right.
Well,
you gotta go in with your eyes down, right? You can't make eye contact.
Yeah, right. That is my Apple Store strategy, actually. I go in, and if someone says something, I can kind of look up, give them a quick brow raise, and I'm just like, hey, and then I just keep walking.
But from a retail perspective, like, guys like us are, I mean, like, we may as well be from another planet. Like, I mean, like, I would never go into an Apple Store without exactly knowing what I need. And, you know, I mean, and that's not the way that most people shop. Like, most people, like, are like, go in and they're, you know, indecisive and they're like, I don't know. And, you know, I don't know what I want. And, you know, and for those people, I mean, there's a reason why every store on the planet has, like, I mean, for me, like, I hate it when somebody comes up to me and is like, can I help you? Can I help you? Like, I'm just kind of like, leave me the hell alone. But for most people, like, I want the anonymity of online shopping, but with the convenience of just being able to walk out with it then and there. Like, that's what I want. But, right. You know, but most people don't know what they want. They're looking, you know, and there's a reason why every store in the planet doesn't just leave you alone when you walk in there. Like, and it's because most people have no idea. And that, you know, a little bit of effort of talking somebody into a purchase is what it takes to actually get their money.
Right. And if you look at it, compared to other stores, I mean, what Browett's problem, I think, is he came from Britain's Best Buy. But it was even cheaper and nastier. You know, yes. They're even more. They push the extended service plans. They push you towards the crappiest products. They have no clue what they're talking about. You know,
it's just a bunch of British thugs working in these things, pushing the hard sell on some crap that you don't want and definitely don't need.
No, that's exactly what it is. Like, Leandro, you've shopped there, right? Like, it's terrible.
Yeah,
like,
it's awful. Absolutely awful. And because, you know, Britain is not exactly known for its, you know, for service.
You go into the Apple Store and there's just some guy rubbing his teeth with his tongue. He's just like, hey, Gov, you gonna buy that or what?
Yeah.
You touch it, you buy it. You're like, geez. Sorry, dude.
The one store I went in when I went in London was the Apple Store, and it was totally Americanized. And it was faintly embarrassing for me as a, you know, as an English person. I wanted them to smell lager and cigarettes and, you know, like, be surly. All the other stores you go in, and they give you a filthy look. You know, it's like shopping at a record store, you know, where they just look you up and down. They think you're a scumbag. And then
that's true. Like, it's true everywhere, too. Like, that's the best thing about Apple stores is, like, no matter where you are in the world, you know, no matter how contemptuous that country is of customer service, you can go into an Apple store and somebody will treat you like a human being again. Like, it's awesome. Like, you know, when I lived in Germany, like, they couldn't, like their goal is to make you, like, want to shit on their grave. Like, and you go into an Apple store and they're like, oh, hello, you know, like, I mean...
We're complaining about the wrong things, you see, because, you know, like, if you do go to a Best Buy, the service is so miserable, and the experience is so miserable. You know, no one in that store knows what they're talking about. They just want to push you towards, you know, the highest margin product. They've got, you know, really crappy selection. They can't help you with things like transferring, you know, from one computer to another. So, you know, you go to an Apple, and why are we? What are we complaining about an Apple store for? There are too many people to help you. What kind of crazy? You know, they know what they're talking about. They don't give you a hard sell. You know,
we're Americans. We are patriotically obligated to complain about something.
Yeah,
right. That was the first thing that came to mind. So that's what I chose.
Very, very entitled.
Well, I think that, I mean, going back to John Browett, I think that, like, you know, I think that, I mean, the big problem is that he tried to, well, first of all, he, like whatever he was trying to do involving cutting hours and cutting customer service, like Apple is kind of known for the Apple Store experience. Like he was trying to wreak some very drastic changes in Apple's most visible part of the business. And that's a big problem. I think it's also interesting that, you know, that was a really bad mishire from Tim Cook. Like Tim Cook's a well-traveled guy. All you have to have done is walked into a Dixon's at like, I think there's one in London Heathrow Airport. So Tim Cook definitely has been exposed to Dixon's customer experience, and he still hired this guy. And like, it's a big misstep. I think it's his biggest misstep in the last year since Steve Jobs died.
I would agree with you on that one, yeah.
That's true, but you got to kind of – it makes me wonder. Like, I was trying to think, you know, why did they hire this guy? And I think it's because, you know, how many people are there in the world that have experience of running – you know, a chain with 300 or 400 stores that's worth several $1 billion worth of business. You know, when Steve Jobs hired Baron Johnson, you know, they were launching a set of stores. Now it's an established business. It has a, you know, it's vastly complex. It's an international chain. You know, I think it's, you're not going to get somebody who runs a KFC franchise, right? In Phoenix, Arizona. You want some-
That would have been so amazing.
Yeah.
Tim Cook brings on like the CEO of KFC to run Apple stores.
Some pimply assistant manager of a local franchise.
Sorry, continue your thought.
there's gotta be a very short list of candidates, I imagine. I mean, you can't turn the business over to somebody who doesn't know what they're doing.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, imagine how hard it must be to find someone of the caliber that they're looking for, right?
Yeah, you know, Ron Johnson built it. So he was obviously uniquely qualified to run this thing. They're just, you know, they have the same problem with filling Steve Jobs' shoes and anybody else at that company. The weird thing is they said that there was tipped a really good candidate, one of the like Ron Johnson's deputy, who'd actually come up from being a store manager and had been helping him run it for several years at that sort of executive level. And I got a tip that he was going to be the next guy, which like about a day later, John Browett. We had a completely wrong tip that this other guy was going to fill his shoes. But yeah, you know, I mean, this is the problem for Apple across the board now. I mean, like that thing, 10Q, to go on to a completely different subject, with that 10Q yesterday, you know, they were talking about how big Apple became in the last year since Jobs died. I mean, you know, like they've got 12,000 more employees, 41 million square foot of space. They put in $10 billion worth of investment in new factories. And
good grief.
Yeah, it's like crazy. I mean, the company's a big, big company.
It is. It's a behemoth, and it's only getting bigger. Well, hey, hold that thought for just a sec, John. I want to continue this discussion, and I also want to talk about Siri and Apple Maps and why they now have a new hope. And speaking of a new hope, you're not going to want to miss the end of the show. We're definitely going to have a conversation about Disney buying Lucasfilm, because there are actually some Apple connections there that you may not be familiar with. And I think this is absolutely the biggest story of the year. I'm so pumped to talk about this. But I want to tell you about our sponsor. They're called DigiDNA. They make a great product called Disk Aid 5. Now, if you've been listening to this show, I'm sure you know who they are. But I want to tell you a little bit about Disk Aid 5. Disk Aid 5 is the iPhone, iPod, and iPad transfer tool for Mac and PC. And it lets you do a ton of cool things that I think you're really going to like. So first and foremost, it lets you access the file system on your iOS device. And why would you want to do that? Well, it makes it really easy to pull down files off your iOS device or actually put files onto your iOS device. So for example, let's say your grandfather left you a voicemail message and you want to save it forever because maybe he just passed away. That's actually a story that we just got from one of our listeners who is using Disk Aid 5. They are able to download that voicemail, keep it on their computer, which is something that you really wouldn't be able to do without Disk Aid 5. Another cool feature, you can download call logs. You can upload, let's say, a movie from your computer to your iPad. Let's say you're going on a plane trip, and you don't want to put a movie into iTunes, then sync iTunes with your iPad or your iPhone. You can just drop it right on your device with Disk Aid 5. And then DigiDNA also makes a free app called File App, which is in the App Store, and you can download that for free. And then it lets you watch that movie, listen to that music, read that book without going through iTunes or iBooks. It also has a really amazing iTunes transfer feature. And I think this is probably one of the best features of it, is that let's say you have your iTunes collection on your iPhone and you use a Mac at home, and you sync your iTunes collection with your iPhone, of course, because you listen to your music on the go. You could go to your office, and with Discade 5, which works on PC as well, you could download your entire iTunes collection right to that PC and then be listening to it just as you were if you were at home. And that includes your metadata, your album art, all that great stuff. I want you to give it a shot. Try it out. Let me know what you think of it. Go to digidna.net. Click on the big Discade 5 icon. You don't have to pay anything to download the app. Some of the basic features are free to use. And if you decide you like it, you can pay for a license to upgrade to some of the more advanced features. And it's normally, I believe, $25. But if you use the code CULTCAST, you'll get 30% off your order. And that's the CULTCAST at checkout. Make sure you put the T-H-E at the beginning. And also, we're going to be giving away 2 free licenses. So if you want to win one of those, go to our Facebook page. That is facebook.com/TheCultCast. Leave us a comment telling us why you deserve a copy of Discade 5. And we'll be picking 2 winners on Monday. I really want to thank DigiDNA for sponsoring the show. They've been with us for a while now, and they're great guys. International, like a lot of you listeners out there, they're all over the place. And I really love Discade 5, so I encourage you to try it. Let's move on to Siri and Maps, because that was one of Scott Forstall's responsibilities, right, guys? And actually, one of the reasons it's rumored that he was let go was because Maps has been, reportedly so bad. You know, I honestly haven't really had any problems with it, but I know other people out there are. John, I know you have been complaining about it because I've seen your complaint. So apparently it hasn't been working for you.
That's for me, it's a joke, but I am constantly on a 3 or 4 times a week basis frustrated by how bad it is. But Leander's experience, for example, is excellent.
So is mine. I've had very few problems with it. I think it works very well.
I mean, you guys both do live in tech capitals of the world, though.
Boston's not. Yeah, Boston's this little tiny backwater, right?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. What? Your city is bigger than mine.
But it's not down the street from Redmond or Cupertino.
True.
Boston is I don't really know what to say about Maps. I know a lot of people have a good time with it and think it's fine. I think it's a disaster. I'm somebody who doesn't drive a lot, but I bike all the time. I just can't get it to give me consistent addresses, and I'm always going to new places just to meet people or to do things, and it's always giving me wrong directions, always, and usually not the same wrong direction twice, which is even
That's weird, because it's supposed to be based on TomTom data, right? And you think TomTom's been around for a long time. In fact, they sell their data to a lot of other mapping companies already, so it's strange why
it's on
having particular problems.
It's based off of I forget what they're actually called. I'm sorry, but it's based off of an open source mapping platform. But the problem is that they're I think it's called OSM. Open, I think it's that simple.
Open Maps, right? Which has a whole bunch of user identified points of interest.
Right, but Apple took a snapshot of what they're basing their maps off of from 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's all based off of that. For example, I live in Somerville, and Cambridge is just one town over. And if I enter an address in Cambridge and say route me to there, it'll often tell me to go to Belmont, which is 5 or 10 miles out of the way, instead of the 1 mile it actually is. That's a constant problem I have with iOS 6 maps.
Wow, see, and that's a problem that I'd never have. I mean, its directions up until this point have been impeccable for me. But, admittedly, yeah, it has been having a lot of problems. And Eddie Q has been given the responsibility of fixing not only Maps, but Siri as well. Now, I didn't know very much about Eddie Q up until this point, but I've been reading about him. And, you know, he's done some great stuff at Apple, so he kind of gives me hope. I mean, he was responsible for building iTunes and negotiating with, you know, music labels or to, you know, make iTunes as profitable and as successful as it is today. But another thing I didn't realize that he did is he helped Apple fully develop their online ordering system for computer systems, which I know at this point in time seems like, well, everybody has that. But I guess when he was doing it, it wasn't really prevalent. I mean, people weren't really ordering a lot of computers online. You would go to a store to do that. So he has been given the task of making those better. Do you guys care to comment on the odds that we're going to be seeing a better Siri in the next 12 months? Because right now, I have totally stopped using Siri. I feel like Siri is much more of a disaster than Maps is.
I had a great tip to get Siri to work right, and that's to address it. Do you say, Siri, search for Irfan's an idiot, and...
And she says, sorry, Leander, he's not.
Exactly. But apparently if you change, if you address it directly, it works a lot better.
And so you guys don't call, like, I always call Siri by her first name. Like, I'm always like, hey, Siri. Like, I really do, like, every time. And it was only until recently that I kind of realized that you didn't actually have to do that.
I had that realization pretty quickly because I felt silly saying, Siri, do this. And then eventually I just realized after seeing those ridiculous Samuel Jackson commercials and I was like, oh, I could just say what I want, you know, like, and John Malkovich especially, like, he wouldn't say anything. He would just operate Siri with the home button and then say weather. And then she would actually give him accurate information. Of course, when I say something like that, Siri never understands what I'm saying. I'm surprised I haven't crashed my car trying to text message with her.
Well, so can we talk about Siri for a second?
Because, please.
Yeah, no, I believe, my belief is, is that the reason that Siri has problems has absolutely, it has to do with capacity. It has nothing to do with the actual technology. I believe that, like, Apple just doesn't have enough server and computer space. Like, because, you know, let's flash back to when the iPhone 4S comes out, right? And, like, this is verifiable because you've got guys like Steve Wozniak saying it. You know, if you go back to the iPhone 4S launch, Siri worked great. You bought an iPhone 4S and you asked them, like, what's the average elevation of the state of Massachusetts, and it would give you an answer. Like, it was fantastic. It would go into Wolfram Alpha. And now if you ask that question, you just get, you know, like, it's you know, this is a, you know,
that's a fact, by the way. That's what happens.
This is over a year later, and that's, you know, you get a nonsense answer. And I think here's the point I want to make about Siri is, like, as more users pile on Siri, you know, everything you say into Siri needs to shoot out to a server. It needs to be processed. And then what is being processed needs to go to various partners like Yelp or Wolfram Alpha, and they need to process it. And it's only then that it comes all back to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that my belief about Siri is that the technology is actually very sound, but that the partners – and maybe even Apple's own infrastructure can't yet handle the incredible volume of requests that are being pushed towards Siri. And I think that over time, to cope with this, they have dumbed Siri down to compensate and to make sure that the more likely questions or requests that come through Siri are actually, you know, given priority, whereas, like, if you ask them about, like, the elevation of a mountain or something, it's like, well, why don't you just go to Google with that?
I swear that Siri says that to me no matter what I say. Well, to your point, I mean, yeah, there are two pieces to it, right? I mean, there is the whole Siri needs to connect to the network to do anything, to answer any of your questions, right? And that's been a problem because sometimes it just takes forever to connect. But my problem has to do with the speech recognition. I feel like Siri misunderstands the words that I say. So I'll say, Siri, what's the weather like today? And Siri will say, I'm sorry, Irfan, I don't understand weather are you today. And I'm like, that's not even what I said. And I immediately go to a 10 on my anger scale because I'm so fed up with it, right? And then you're in your car trying to drive, which is why you're using Siri in the first place. And I'm like, it would literally be safer for me to not be looking at the road and text message this, you know, than try to ask Siri, because Siri just makes me so angry because she never understands what I say. But Leander, you said that she understands you all the time, right? Like, you don't really.
Well, it's inconsistent. You know, the last time I was on the podcast, yeah, it was perfect. Then, like, you then? In the car the other day trying to get to call my son, and I made about 8 different calls to different people, and like you, I nearly crashed trying to cancel these calls that it wasn't supposed to make to people I haven't spoken to in years. Does the speech processing happen on locally, or does that get sent to the cloud?
That happens in the cloud, and that's the other thing. I think that when there are, like, my theory is that when there's peak traffic on Siri's network, it doesn't spend as much time thinking about each request, and
it's a great
experience.
Yeah, it's a great theory. I mean, surely we could test it out. I mean, there must be a way. You know, there must be a time, 3 a.m. in the morning, when you can get up and give it a whirl, and see if it's any better, right?
Yeah, we should do that. Actually, we should do that like next week or something. We should try to put together. Like an actual experiment on this. Like, I really do think that's the reason. I think that it's all highly invisible, but I believe that there's a lot of factors, but a lot of it has to do with traffic in regards to Siri.
This has a lot to do with, you know, Bob Mansfield being promoted to that position of, you know, like semiconductor new technologies, where he's looking at semiconductors and networking technologies. And, you know, at first you're like wireless, you know, like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. I mean, what's that got to do with it? But of course, it's got everything to do with it, because all the processing happens in the cloud now.
Yeah.
And, these, you know, the iPad and the iPhone, the locus of your computing life used to be your desktop machine. But, you know, now it's a server. It's one of Apple's servers on the East Coast. You know, improving that latency, you know, has everything to do with improving the experience. So did you check out the new Google search app? That was just released today or yesterday?
I haven't had a chance to play around with it yet. Have you?
No, but there was some. I saw a couple of comments about it, and they were saying, okay, this is how, you know, Siri should work. There's no latency. The recognition's almost perfect.
Well, I mean, this is. But that makes a lot of sense. Like, look at Google's infrastructure. Like, they've got it all together. Like, you know, and I mean, if my theory is correct, that has a lot to do with, you know. Apple's own data capacity, how much processing power they can put towards recognition and stuff like that. Of course, Google's got them beat. Like, they're just a juggernaut. Like, I'm actually less impressed with Google. I think it's called, you know, it's Google Now. I'm less impressed with the, like, you know, the results of saying, you know, of asking it like natural language questions. You know, than I am with Siri. Like, that's one of Siri's great strengths, is you can ask it like, you know, what movies are playing near me, or like, you know, how many gallons of water a local lake has. And it will tell you through its Wolfram partnership. And like, unfortunately, Google Now just doesn't have that same sort of chops, I don't think. But it's much faster, which is nice.
Right. Well, they're saying that Google's voice recognition is much about, like, you know, just that, right? Voice recognition doesn't have any AI. It can't make sense of terms, of relative terms, or, you know, it doesn't do any parsing of the language to look for meaning.
It's a verbal AskJeeves.com, basically.
I need to play around with it. Let's bring this back to Eddie Q, because Eddie is now tasked with the job of fixing all these said problems. I have hope that he can. He has done great stuff, I think, with Mobile Me. He helped it transition to iCloud. And he's kind of become Apple's Mr. Fix-It. He's the guy that you don't really hear about all that often. Have you guys noticed that? But the more I look at his record, I'm like, gosh, this guy's actually done a lot of crap. P-I-M-P. Hey, let's wrap up with one of my favorite segments, and that is Faves and Raves, the segment where we talk about our favorite apps and hardware and then vote on which one's best. And then stay tuned for after the show. We're going to have a conversation about Disney, Lucasfilm, and what that has to do with Apple. But hey, John, do you want to go ahead and tell us what your Fave and Rave pick is for the week?
Yeah, sure. I didn't have it before, but I just thought of it now.
Perfect. That's the way we like it.
There's an app called Track 8. Mm-hmm. For the iPhone and iPad. I don't know who made it, so I will look it up right
Apparently
now.
Apparently somebody's typing to look it up.
Yeah, I am typing to look it up. but I would like to give them the proper shout out. So it's by Ender Labs, and they're, I mean, like, it's a iPod, like a music app replacement for the iPhone and the iPod and iPod Touch. And
that's the one that you said kind of operated like a Zune, right?
Oh no, yeah, no, it's got the Windows phone and Zune approach to music management, and I love it. Like, I don't find myself using it a lot, but I didn't find myself using the music.app a lot either. The big reason there is because I've kind of moved everything to streaming services like RDO at this point. But Track 8's great. Like, it's beautiful. It's really pleasant to use. It's a really, like, visually interesting app. You know, I really love it. It streams things from the cloud. Like, and I find Apple's own music app just, like, very, very frustrating to use, very ugly. Like, it's not something I want to open. And I really like Track 8. It's better on the iPad than the iPhone, I would say that. Like, on the iPhone, I'll occasionally get bugs that sort of irritate me. But on the iPad, it's a very solid app.
Is it free or is it cost something?
No, it's $1.99.
Oh, $1.99.
Now, you know what? You can spend $2 for a good app.
No, like, I can.
I have no sympathy.
But there's a lot of people who don't. Like, I'm like, $2? I'm like, it's $2. Like, I think about $2 on my wallet, what I wouldn't spend that on. I'm like, I'd spend $2 on pretty much anything.
Yeah. No, buy it. It's great. It's fantastic. Okay. And, like, you've also got Cult of Mac Chops. Like, I'm sure they'd send you a review code.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I don't even have to spend my $2. That'll be worth the 20 minutes it'll take for me to get a review code.
What's your endorsement worth? Like 100? Yeah, something.
Yeah, no, I'd say more like $5 max. Leander, what do you got?
Well, I've actually got – first of all, I was going to say that John's Fave and Rave was – my Fave and Rave last week. So also remember, yeah, I chose Track 8.
Oh, really? Was it? Oh, nice.
Yeah. But now I've completely lost confidence in my Fave and Rave because I'm going to be voting for John.
Well, I remember telling you last week that it was really bad. Don't you remember that? Yeah, now it's been confirmed.
Let me know what my Fave and Rave next week is going to be. I'm really interested.
Well, maybe you could do what I'm about to talk about now. We could just he pitched it better, though. I made a fatal mistake in the way I talked about it.
By comparing to the Zune?
Yeah, exactly.
That pretty much lost you that contest. Yeah. Exactly. So, what do you got for us this week?
Well, I did a review. I did a rave about the Apple's Maps. You know, on the website a week or so ago.
And, yeah.
I had a picture of the smartphone holder that I use in my car, and a whole bunch of people asked me what it was. You know, said it looked great, and it's a $6 holder I got from Walgreens. So very, very inexpensive, but it's actually, you know, it's worked out great because I put it onto the heater. I clipped it onto the heater vent, and when I had the heater on, it heated my iPhone up to dangerous levels, and it just shut down. With that warning sign, you know, I had a little yellow triangle on it saying your iPhone's about to explode.
Yeah, and send Gorilla Glass into your face.
Right. So I took it off the grill, luckily it came with a little sticky pad mounting strip. Mm-hmm. And so I stuck it in a different place. And of course I was like, this isn't even going to be here in the morning. It's going to fall off. And to my great surprise, it's been on now for a couple of weeks. And I think that is the longest I've ever had, you know, any kind of, glue mounted hardware ever stay in place. So this is the reason I'm giving it and making a Fave and Rave, simply because it's, you know, it's still there. It's still stuck to my car dashboard. And it's by Custom Accessories. It's called the Adjustable MP3 Player. You can get it at almost every single store, Walgreens, O'Reilly's.
And it's $6.
It's $6. And you can even get it on Amazon. But you know, it's sort of, it stood that it's nothing fancy. It's just a you know, a smartphone holder. And it's actually worked out great, and it hasn't fallen off. So that's why I'm about.
Wow. That's funny because I use a iPhone holder that I got from Amazon, and I can't remember the name of it, although I should find it for future shows, but it was only $12. And this thing is a champion. It has a suction cup that is detachable, and it's expandable, so it fits pretty much any smartphone if it's in a case or not. But that's not my pick, so why don't I stop talking about that? My pick is actually an app, and it's a free app. You can put it on your iPhone, and it also has a desktop app. It's called Productive, T-E-E-V, because they're trying to be different there. I've been looking for a new to-do app, and that's what Productive is. Because, as you guys know, Wunderlist is one of the more popular ones out there. But I don't know if you guys have had this problem with Wunderlist. It was spinning constantly and using my CPU, because Wunderlist syncs over the cloud, and it keeps your iPad app, your iPhone app, and your Mac app all up to date with all your tasks and everything. But for some reason, mine has stopped working. And it would just sit there and spin and spin and spin and spin. And it would make my computer heat up. It would drain my battery. I emailed them several times about it, and they just never even got back to me. I did some Google searches, and it looks like several other people have been having the same problem. So finally, I was like, I just need to switch and stop using Wunderlist. So I found Productive, and it's great. It allows you to work with other people on tasks if you like. You can set up different groups of tasks. It has built-in notifications. It syncs across your Mac and your iPhone, and it's really good for, you know, focusing on different sets of tasks and actually getting them done. I mentioned it is free, and you can work with up to one other person on those tasks for that price, and you guys can send each other and assign each other different tasks. And then there's a paid version, or I should say a paid upgrade, where if you want, you can work with multiple people in like a business environment or a team environment and assign those tasks to each other so you can help each other get stuff done. Oh my gosh, I'm so happy to finally have another to-do list app, because it's really hard for me to be productive without one, if you will. So that's my pick. John, I'm going to let you vote first. What sounds best?
By the way,
you can't vote for your own, in case you don't remember that.
Obviously, it's the $6, like, you know. No. In all seriousness, any $6 product that works like a champ, that is worthy of all the accolades you can put on it. So my vote is for Leander's.
All right.
Leander, who's are you voting for?
Well, I got to go for John. I just got a new to-do app too. And, you know, to-do apps are really all about themselves. You spend more time organizing your tasks and trying to make sense of the goddamn app instead of actually doing what, you know, the tasks you actually put into it.
That's true, actually. That's one of my tasks. Learn to use the to-do app.
Sorry, can I ask you guys a question? Why don't you use Reminders? Like, I love Reminders. It's all iCloud synced. It's on Mountain Lion. It's on iOS. Like, I use it for everything. It's fantastic.
Wow. I find its user interface to be so hideous that I can't bear to look at it.
Oh.
It has no features either, which OSL really, really bothers me.
But you can use Siri, right? And actually, Siri does work really well if you set a reminder. Actually, that's one of the things that actually works in Siri.
Oh, yeah, that's what I want to do. Use Siri to set reminders.
No, you do. Because 90, like, I have never had Siri fuck up a reminder. Like, I mean, like, those are the things that can kind of do on board. And, like, it's great. Like, you know, like, I walk out of, like, getting a haircut and I'll be like, Siri, remind me to get a haircut again in 6 weeks. And it does it. Like, it's fantastic.
and in 6 weeks you get a reminder that says, John, don't forget your Hare Krishna crutting, and you're like, what does this mean?
Well, I just automatically know that means.
Exactly. Oh yeah, it's time for me to get my Hare Krishna cutting. Okay, cool. I better go in and then do that. Well, Leander, you win, because I'm voting for yours. To John's point, any accessory that's only $6 that actually works is worth buying, especially when it's as useful as something that holds your iPhone 5 in place while you're driving, so you can yell at Siri at full volume without having to yell at your hand. So what was it called again?
I just closed the windows. Oh my god.
Okay, well, make sure you back up 20 seconds and let's do it.
All right, yeah,
and exactly. It's available on Amazon, and it holds your iPhone 5.
It's Custom Accessories. That's the name of the company. Custom Accessories, adjustable MP3 phone holder.
There you go. $6.
On a part number, it's 10950. So I'm sure
can you read us the UPC code as well? That would be great.
That's an amazing, like, Samsung-like designation. or, you know, Sony-like designation, rather, for, like, a product. Like, oh, yeah, if you want it, just go ask for X1233JPQ.
Rolls right off the tongue. Well, hey, guys, that's it. That's all the time we have for today. We're going to insert our Star Wars conversation after the music, so if you want to stick around for that, please do. I want to thank DigiDNA for sponsoring the show. Go over to digidna.net, download Discade 5, and I'm at Erfon, E-R-F-O-N, on Twitter. Let me know what you think of it, and definitely make sure you hop onto our Facebook page, facebook.com/TheCultCast, and let us know why you deserve a free license to the more advanced features on Discade 5. And hey, you know what? The conversation continues on Twitter. As I said, I'm at Erfon, Leander is L. Caney, and John, you are Dr. Crypt, and that's D-R-C-R-Y-P-T, yes?
I am.
Fantastic, and they both have amazing tweets, so you should definitely go follow them there. This has been the CultCast, the best, usually 30-minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. New episodes of the CultCast come out every Thursday night. Stay tuned for some Star Wars Disney talk. We will see you guys next time. Is that what your bird sounds like, John?
No, that sounds like a
dribble. Hey, good reference. All right, let's talk about some Star Wars, shall we? Why not make the show a little longer? This might end up being the longest show we've ever done, including our special megasodes when new hardware comes out. But I definitely am excited to talk about this because I thought this was huge news. So for those that don't know, quite surprisingly to everyone, it was announced this week that Disney was going to buy the entirety of Lucasfilm, which is 100% owned by George Lucas himself. John, why don't we start with you? Initial thoughts? Is this a good or a bad thing? What do you think?
Awesome thing. I mean,
yeah.
This is like, I can't imagine the human who would say this is bad. Like, because a bunch of things. First of all, George Lucas is donating all of the $4 billion that he's making off the sale, which incidentally is a complete steal as far as Disney is concerned. Because
I know, that was it's really low priced. I mean, Disney bought Pixar for $7 billion, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So why only?
And Pixar doesn't have like a franchise like Star Wars.
Oh, they don't have nearly the IP as Lucasfilm, not to mention all the other businesses that Lucasfilm owns.
Oh, yeah, no.
I don't know. What about Toy Story? They got a bunch of IP, really.
Toy Story is not Star Wars.
Star Wars is the franchise.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's true, actually, because Cars, the new Cars movie, they sold more Cars crap than any other branded toy ever, right?
I haven't heard that, but it could be true.
I think you're using, you know, your own Star Wars fandom to.
Whoa,
you know,
don't call me a Star Wars fan. I have
we're not alone. I've seen this a lot. You know, everyone, all the bloggers are exactly the same. They're like, whoa, you know, Star Wars, this is awesome. You know, because everyone grew up on Star Wars. But I think Cars is actually the most valuable brand.
Wow, I find that hard to believe. I mean, you're right. I am looking at this through.
Okay, I'm gonna look it up.
Okay, yeah, definitely look it up.
Yeah, look it up.
I like you, John. At first I was like, whoa, I don't know how I feel about this, but this makes perfect sense, right? I mean, if you're a Star Wars fan, and I am, I mean, I'm not like dressing up as Luke Skywalker every Halloween, and I'm not LARPing in the park, you know. But
a good Lando, though.
Oh, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment, actually. I think he's like one of the best characters.
He is the best character. And he has a mustache.
Hair's kind of curly. Yeah, I like that. Here's what I think. George Lucas has been apathetic about Star Wars for years. I have heard rumors that, you know, on the last three Star Wars, so the episodes one, two, and three, like, he didn't even want to do them. He was trying to get Steven Spielberg to do them, and Spielberg was like, I'm not doing these. You need to do these. These are your movies, right? And the reason that George Lucas ended up making these films is because there was so much pressure for him to do it. I don't know how true that is, but that's what I've heard. And then you see the movies, and the writing was of questionable quality. I mean, the plots of the movies weren't that great. Industrial Light and Magic, which Lucasfilm owns, made the special effects amazing. I mean, the movies look amazing. But it just kind of became clear to me that George Lucas was no longer passionate about Star Wars. And it's unfortunate, really, because I think... I mean, if you watch the documentary, The People versus George Lucas, they talk a lot about this. Like, he was a filmmaker, and then Star Wars blew up to be this thing that he didn't expect. It became so massively popular that it transformed him from a filmmaker into a business person. And he went about his days operating the business that is Star Wars and all its multiple pieces, you know? And he just wasn't really passionate about creating good Star Wars movies anymore. And I think that he was smart. He recognized that this needed to continue, and he wasn't able to do it. And he even said in the press release, he's like, I'm excited for other filmmakers to pick up where I'm leaving off and create more amazing Star Wars movies. And just imagine, Disney's going to own the Indiana Jones franchise, right? So they could reboot those. They could make a Star Wars theme park. They can start making Star Wars movies that actually have amazing plots now. They're going to own Industrial Light and Magic, which is one of the best special effects studios in the world. That's going to make their movies better. And Disney owns Pixar, too. And Pixar movies are obviously very story-driven.
Well, I think this is, you know, something that's very worth saying. It opens the door for a Pixar Star Wars film.
Exactly. Exactly. That would be very cool.
Irfan, like, you know, if you're not done, then, you know, continue. But, like, God, I disagree with almost everything you said outside of, like, that this is exciting. Like, about
well, this
George
is America.
Lucas
you have every right to be wrong.
Like, I am very, like, I mean, George Lucas for me is like a creator gone mad. Like, I mean, this is a guy who's, you know, I mean, there's a lot of reasons that are way too in-depth for this podcast. But this is a guy who... with the prequels, like he didn't do it because he felt too much pressure. Like he, you know, he did them because he actually wanted to do them. And, you know, in my opinion, like, the reason those are garbage is because George Lucas is somebody who has lost any editorial control. There's no longer anybody around him who is giving him good ideas. Like, you know, the prequels are bad films. Like, they really are. They're badly written. They are artlessly written. They're films that are done without, like, all of the people who helped make Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back great left. And those people are his co-writers. Those people are his ex-wife. You know, but I think more important than that, you know, more important than that, though, is like George Lucas, despite being somebody who has kind of run away as a creator, I really admire him for his charity work. Like, he has publicly stated that he believes that the job of the wealthy is to, you know, to be philanthropists. And I really admire that about him. Like, I don't know if you've heard about... like for 30 years, he had been trying to do something with the LucasArts property that had been like kind of opposed every step of the way by the local town board, which was like you know, made up of millionaires people, and they every step of the way they were very, very concerned that George Lucas's developments on like the LucasArts property would negatively impact the value of what. Of their estates. And so what he did like last year was he basically said, okay, well, I'm not going to open like a business on this land anymore because you fought it for 20 years. Instead, what I'm going to do is open this to low-income housing.
Wow.
And yeah, like...
that was a particularly cruel and ironic way of getting back at those the NIMBYs in Marin County.
Yeah, but now it makes sense, right? Because he... collected $4 billion, which is way lower an asking price than Disney could have paid. Like, I think they could have gone Instagram is worth $1 billion. Like, George Lucas could have gotten more than $4 billion for not only Star Wars, not only Indiana Jones, but Industrial Light and Magic.
Skywalker Sound, Skywalker Ranch. I mean, all those things were included in the deal.
Yeah, what's the name of his sound, the sound thing that every theater uses? What is that called?
THX?
Yeah, THX. That's all in the package. $4 billion is chump change. But then he took that $4 billion as the sole owner, and he donated it all to charity. That's what he's announced
today.
That's
amazing. Yeah, I didn't even know that until you told me.
Who did he actually give it to? Do you know, John?
I don't know. I do know. He has pledged it to improve education in America. How can you go wrong there? Like, I mean, this is a guy who, whatever you might think of him as a man who peaked creatively in the early 80s, is a person who is 100% behind philanthropy. And, like...
Well, he's given half his money to the Giving Pledge, right? The Bill Gates pledge.
Yeah.
OGD? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he's one of the signatories to that.
John, you just said, you know, no matter what you think about him, you know, if you think that he peaked creatively, you know, in the 80s, you know, I honestly don't think that. I think that's one of the most exciting things about this announcement is I was reading through the press release. And one of the things that George Lucas said is he's excited to get back to making films, and he has ideas for films, and he's going to be a creative consultant on the Star Wars movies, of course, so he's still going to have input there. But this gives him an opportunity to get back to that creativity that he was so good at. And yeah, he might put out a bad movie or two, but I mean, he's still relatively young. What is he, in his mid-50s? Like, he's got time left. Hopefully, we could see more amazing movies from George Lucas.
Well, what are these amazing movies you're talking about before Star Wars?
American Graffiti.
American Graffiti. Indiana Jones is after Star Wars. And, like, I mean, if he can't do a good Indiana Jones or Star Wars movie, I'm like, he is 100% in control of those franchises. You can't blame Jar Jar Binks on somebody who's placating fans, because like fans hated Jar Jar Binks. Like, no one wanted Jar Jar Binks. Like, that's a George Lucas thing.
Like, I don't know though. Like, when you say fans hated Jar Jar Binks, I totally get what you're saying, because I'm not a huge fan of it, of that thing either. But in the documentary, The People versus George Lucas, they interviewed some hardcore fans, and one of the points they made that I thought was good was, like, Jar Jar Binks isn't for people who are already fans. Like, he's for the kids, and he's for the new generation of Star Wars fans. And then you interview kids, and the kids all love Jar Jar Binks, right? Okay. And you're like, well, did he make this movie for adults, or did he make it for kids?
Well, let's talk about this for a second, because George Lucas has only directed two non-franchise films. One is THX 1138. The other one is American Graffiti. American Graffiti is a really good movie. I like watching it. THX 1138 is like rough, but also good. I really like watching it. But in a career that spans, at this point, over 40 years, George Lucas has only directed 6 movies. And 4 of them have been Star Wars films. Mm-hmm. And 3 of those Star Wars films have been atrocious. Like, so I guess what I'm trying to say here is that, like, George Lucas, you talk about George Lucas as an artist who, like, inadvertently became a businessman. I think that George Lucas's record speaks for itself. He is a franchise builder. He is a businessman. He is incidentally a director. Like, you know, and I mean, if you look at the stuff that, I mean, George Lucas is at his best when he's encouraging other people's talents. Like, you look at his curriculum, like, you know, he did Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's a Steven Spielberg production. He did Body Heat. He did, Labyrinth. Like, he did all sorts of cool stuff. You know, he produced a Woody Allen movie. Like, he's great at that stuff. He's also amazing at spinning out properties, and that's why Disney wants them, because Disney, like, just like they bought up Marvel a couple of years ago, they're looking to expand their
all about franchises.
They're franchises. But, like, I mean, as as a unique creator, like, you guys should watch these video reviews of the Star Wars prequel done by it's a YouTube guy called Red Letter Media, and he has kind of like this weird persona in his reviews that I don't particularly care for, of like a secret murderer, but all of the points he makes about what has happened to George Lucas are incredibly sound. Like, this is a guy who has lost his anybody who is telling him, well, I don't necessarily think that that's, you know, the right way to go. Like, he's kind of like a Steve Jobs character gone mad.
Yeah, in a way, he's like the victim of his own success, right? Because everyone around him, you're saying, is kind of have kind of become yes men, and no one's willing to challenge him on his creative ideas.
Yeah, they're petrified of him.
Yeah, well, like John was saying, you know, I don't agree the last three prequels were unmitigated disasters. They were movies that were in desperate need of an editor.
Like, yes.
and they're actually quite, if you watch those fan cuts, they're actually quite watchable movies. And the last one was great. I mean, it was basically ripped off the plot of The Godfather 2, with Anakin, you know, in the Michael Corleone corrupted by evil role. But I thought, you know, it was quite a compelling movie. It was just way too long and bloated.
There was a lot of bloat in there.
Have you heard about, you guys know who Topher Grace is? He apparently did his own little fan edit of the prequels into one 90-minute movie, and he was just like, showed it to all of his Hollywood friends once, and then was like, I'm never going to show this again because I'll, you know, get sued and it's all sorts of trouble. But apparently, by people who have seen it, it's amazing. Like, it really condenses those first three movies into like a 100-minute film that you actually want to watch. And like, you know, they ditch most of the Phantom Menace. They cut out all sorts of things. But like, I really agree with what Leander's saying. Like, he's got editing problems now. Like, as do most aged artists. Like, look at Stephen King, like a writer who wrote really taut, you know, great masterful works when he was like in his early 30s, who gained too much editorial control and now writes like very bloated books.
He just is like, I'm going to do whatever I want. It's going to be 3,000 pages.
Well, it's true. There's a lot of hubris that goes along with being an artist. And like,
all right. You know, those guys were great. I mean, great art comes from constraints, really. And, you know, sort of one of the things about having, you know, all these guys. I mean, Scorsese is the same, right? I mean, his latest movie was his movies are awful, but when they had no money and they had no time, and they were just cranking stuff out and they had nothing to lose, they could take all the chances in the world. That's when the great stuff comes out. I can't see any great work coming from him. And didn't Lucas say the same thing as well after he delivered the last prequel? He said, "Oh, now I'm going to get back to, you know, making small independent movies," but he didn't actually do anything, did he?
No.
But now he actually has the time to do it.
George Lucas is a businessman now. Like, I mean, he's, you know, if you ever read, like, there are these amazing transcripts of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, the discussions that happened before they did Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it's like Steven Spielberg and Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark, but also wrote Empire that Strikes Back, and then it's George Lucas, and that's like, if you read these transcripts, it's amazing. Like, this guy has a mind that is just so overflowing with ideas. Like, this is a guy who gets how film works. Like, he gets how all of this happens. And, you know, in this 8-hour session, the first three Indiana Jones movies were born. Like all of these scenes that you think of as iconic Indiana Jones scenes happens in this one meeting in early 1980. Between these guys, like they so many ideas that they had to spell it out for all three movies. And like, you know, George Lucas really had it then, but I just don't think he's thinking that way anymore. And like, and also like, now he'll try to throw all of these ideas into one film. Like, look at, you know, any of the Star Wars prequels. Like, it's just like, it's like this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, and it's like exhausting. But it's because he's lost people who are just saying, like, well, maybe this is too many ideas for one thing.
You know, it's interesting. When I think about the sale of Lucasfilm to Disney is that, Steve Jobs is one of the biggest individual stockholders of Disney, which must mean that his wife now owns a majority of Lucasfilm, right? If Steve Jobs was still alive, he'd be a majority shareholder in Star Wars, the franchise.
Yeah. And it's funny because he bought Pixar was Lucas's fledgling
right.
animation yeah. shop. And in fact, Lucas had, that wasn't the greatest deal either, really. I mean, he offloaded that because he was getting a divorce and he needed some cash quick to pay his wife off. And he sold it to Jobs for $5 million, I think, and then Jobs poured in $5 million of his own money to keep it afloat for a few years.
Yeah.
So everyone says Lucas is a great businessman. Lucasfilm cheap and Jobs got Pixar cheap. I guess when it comes to selling up, he's not the businessman that everyone says he is.
Yeah, maybe he's good at building the business but not selling them.
Right. Yeah.
I think maybe once he gets tired, I've heard George Lucas say he just wants to spend more time with his family and his kids.
It's a strange burden, isn't it? Because he's actually been very generous with fans and stuff. I mean, he's always supported fans and fan-made movies, and he seems quite a generous guy, as well as philanthropically, just sort of socially generous.
Yeah, and that's actually one of my worries. Is that's one of the things I like about George Lucas the most, especially he's a big fan of having the world, take over the Star Wars franchise and make their own fan art and fan movies and stuff. But Disney notoriously is known for prosecuting intellectual property violations, and I'm kind of hoping that they will adopt the same strategy, or at least leave fans to make their own edited versions of films. Not commercially, obviously, but also creating like fan versions of the films and not prosecuting them for doing so, because that's a huge part of the Star Wars community.
Right. Yeah. Disney's not going to allow that. I mean, they're, like you said, they're notoriously tight with their IP.
Yeah. There goes my recreation of Star Wars with you as Princess Leia and John as R2-D2. And John's been working on that for months now.
Oh yeah.
Well, I think it's exciting, hands down. I think it's amazing that this deal happened, and I'm excited to see where these franchises go from here, because obviously George Lucas can't do this forever, and I think that Star Wars is in very capable hands.
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons to be enthusiastic about that. Like, all of the best things for about 20 or 30 years about Star Wars have all come from not George Lucas's brain, but from, like, people associated with the franchise. Like, you've got Knights of the Old Republic, which is like an Xbox game. That's fantastic. You've got novels, like expanded universe novels that are great. Like, I mean, George Lucas, his ideas, on Star Wars, like, it belongs to, like, Star Wars belongs to people besides George Lucas now. Like,
I agree.
George Lucas, it belongs to all of us. And I know that's a little hippie, but, like, George Lucas, as the guardian of Star Wars, has done things that most Star Wars fans consider to be, like, betrayals. Like, the way he has altered the original films, and I think that
hand shot first,
these are things that, like, and he has said, like, well, it's my work, I can do it, and I guess that's a good position for him, but I think most or all of us feel very differently about that. Like, and I really think this bodes well. Like, I think it opens up the Star Wars universe in regards to cinema to the same breadth of talent that we see in every other aspect of media. So, like, it's not, like, 5 years from now, who's to say that Joss Whedon, who is also under the Disney umbrella now because of Avengers and has done space stuff before with Firefly and Serenity, like, Joss Whedon could do a Star Wars movie. Like, it's a great, great thing, I think.
Let's just hope that if we get more Star Wars movies, we get an updated Spaceballs.
Woo!
We should wrap it up, guys, but I just want to end with this. May the Force be with you.
You too.
That's my best Wookiee. That's the best Wookiee I can do.